Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now, imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
But I thought, you know, these guys,
the
they do podcasts all the time. They must know.
Yeah. how little you understand. UK Tech Weekly Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the UK Tech Weekly Podcast. I am surrounded by a plethora of techies this morning because we're going to be talking about our favourite things of the year. We're going to talk about two things each. We're going to go round in an anti-clockwise manner, but you don't care because you can't see us. And we're going to start with Dominic Preston, who is sitting to my right. We are also going to cap all of our favourite things at 5 minutes so that we don't bore you to tears. But you can also just not listen if we bore you to tears. Dom Preston.
don't do that.
Yeah, just turn it off. We'll keep talking. It's fine.
We will. We will keep talking regardless. Dom Preston, what did you like in the year of our Lord 2018?
So I tried to have a thing. I was really trying hard to think of something that was actually like a tech thing, like a gadget or a device I loved this year. And there really wasn't anything. You know, there's nice bits of tech I've had this year, but I haven't used anything that I've really absolutely loved. So I've done the boring thing and gone with a film and a game.
Nice.
So this game first, which is Return of the Obra Dinn, which is the first game in years by a guy called Lucas Pope, who you may know for making the game Papers, Please, which was a little indie title years ago where you played as an immigration border agent for a fictional Soviet country, and you basically did paperwork, and you just went through a lot of paperwork, checking people's passports, stamping them for approval, things like that, and you sort of slowly were forced into making these sort of ethical decisions about immigration as you went on, and it sort of explored the way bureaucracy can sort of hinder our ethical options. Return of the Obra Dinn is very different, but just as interesting and weird and wonderful. It's you play as an insurance agent who is exploring a ship called the Obra Dinn in the, I think it's the 19th century. It's a ship that sort of returned to port completely empty of all of its crew. And it's your job to figure out what happened to them and piece together the story of the Obra Dinn. And you have this sort of this clock device that lets you basically replay people's final moments, the moments they die. Ooh. So you're going around the ship, finding these points where you can play out someone's death, and you sort of then get all of these out of order. So it's up to you to sort of piece together the order of the narrative from seeing all these different deaths. And sort of in doing, you've also got to fill out this log, so you've got to identify people. So you're using little snippets of information. So you watch some person's death scene, and in that, someone calls someone by the name Graham. And then someone else mentions a Graham somewhere else, and you can eventually piece together, oh, this Graham must be that Graham who was the first mate's assistant.
Yeah.
And you're sort of doing all this, and there's this network of clues, this sort of web of information you're building up about the lives of these people. Who knew what, who had these connections? There's a lot of trial and error as you sort of piece it together. And as this sort of then sort of low-key Lovecraftian narrative plays out, and you start to realise all the weird shit that happened on this ship.
I can see why it doesn't have a mainstream appeal when the first line was, you play an insurance agent.
Yeah.
On a ship. But clearly it goes above and beyond its sort of log line.
Yeah, absolutely. Which is, you know, the same, I think that's sort of Pope's thing. I mean, the same with Papers, Please, you know, you play as an immigration officer.
Yeah.
Like, hard sell, mate.
Yeah.
But, you know,
that's
Papers, Please
game.
Was one of the best games.
That was a really good game.
Absolutely.
I just loved role-playing as a Soviet agent. It was fantastic.
And honestly, I think I prefer Obra Dinn. It's got more interesting gameplay, but just as interesting a way of tying gameplay and narrative together and really making them seamless. And it's a mechanic I've not really seen it spoiled before. I'd love to see more games do this kind of thing. It's also got a really beautiful aesthetic, even more so than Papers, Please, which had a cool visual style. This is this wonderful sort of grayscale look. It looks like it's purposely drawing on sort of the early eras of PC adventure games where you had very limited graphics, but in a way that then is set in this 3D world that feels very realizable. And you can still make out enough detail even in this sort of grayscale setting where all this stuff plays out. It's a really, really wonderful game. You can play through it in about 4 or 5 hours.
Oh, nice.
I sort of bought it thinking, oh, yeah, I'll you know, like, play this in a few days because I was in the middle of reviewing something else. And I just thought, I'll dip in for half an hour and see what it's like. And 5 hours later, there I was at the end credits having spent all night playing this.
Excellent. That's a sign of a great game. Right on time. Jumping on to Tamlin McGee.
Wait, I've got to do a film, don't I?
No, we'll go round.
Oh, we're going round one.
Yeah.
All right, ignore me.
Tamlin.
Completely predictably, I've been warned not to talk about this too much because we dedicated half of a podcast to it, but Red Dead Redemption 2 is just probably one of my favourite video game experiences ever.
It probably deserves the amount of time we've given it.
It's fantastic, and it just kept me surprised the whole way through. Aside from just being a fantastic cowboy simulator, what more could you want? The story, the set pieces, and just how long it went on for as well. Like, without spoiling it, I assume everyone has got it, probably played it through already by now anyway, but like there's a good 60 hours of story driven gameplay in there, which is just enormous. I think when it first came out, people were talking about the size of the map and oh my god, it's 100 gigs or whatever, but yeah. You see why, because it's just like a living, breathing world and it's just phenomenal. Enjoyed it a lot.
Bro, did anyone else play it? I haven't played it yet.
I didn't actually. I'm sort of curious. I do want to play it. I've not played the first Red Dead either of them. And I'm not normally a massive fan of Rockstar's games. Like, I like the GTA stuff, but they tend to bore me after a while. I've never really gotten into them. I'm really curious to play Red Dead because it sounds like it might be a game I hate, but it might be a game that's really interesting. I'm really curious when it was sort of the way Zelda Breath of the Wild totally transformed open world games last year. It sounds like Red Dead sort of has some of the stuff from that in different directions and...
You know what, it is Rockstar-esque. There's a lot of fetch quests, and you go to this location and shoot these people or whatever. But also, if you love the Western genre, which I do, I've been watching loads of them this year, it's just, there's so many homages paid to, like, classic Western films in ways that you just wouldn't expect as well. Yeah. So it just, like...
That's what they've always been so good at, and that's why I love Vice City, because Vice City has so many great kind of film references.
A whole quest line with Spinal Tap, basically.
Yeah.
As well.
And it's interesting, because obviously the first Red Dead had a lot of film homages, so it was like, what vein could they tap for this one? But I've heard there's a lot of kind of Wild Bunch, kind of the more... sort of misanthropic Westerns in there.
There's a split-second Searchers reference when you're shoveling shit, literally, and I just didn't expect it at all. It really took me, really
That's
surprising.
Great. Yeah, no, so it's layered.
Yeah, it's just a phenomenal game.
Bro.
Anyway.
David Price?
Well, this follows on quite nicely, actually, because I want to talk about a Western.
Oh, yes.
The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, which is the latest Coen Brothers film, which has been released on Netflix, which is quite interesting in itself, and was originally going to be a television series split into 6 episodes, but instead, and I don't know what the commercial pressures that led to this decision were, but they've made it into a single film split into 6 completely disparate strands. So you just have sort of, I guess, 10, 20 minutes of one story, and then it ends and is never spoken of again.
No.
The characters never come back, and then just moves on to the next. And there's these six strands. And you watch it, and it blew my mind. I thought it was the best Coen Brothers film I'd seen in a long time, the best film I've seen in a long time. Really violent, really funny,
really strange as well.
Really strange. I like that's what I want from my Coen Brothers films. I like that they've never compromised on that. Like, you go back to the first ones, and this is no less strange than those. Or do I mean no more strange? I don't know who else has seen it.
Yeah, I've seen it, loved it. I'm not sure if it was commercial pressures that turned this from an anthology series into a movie. I think it was possibly more an aesthetic decision.
It might be the other way around.
Originally, they were working on it as a movie, actually. They've been working on it for like years and years.
Oh, and
years.
Then it went to TV and then back to movie.
Right. Yeah, okay.
But you can kind of tell, obviously, from its structure that it started out as a TV show and then they kind of use this storybook mechanism to kind of link them together. But I did, when I started the movie, I expected them to overlap, and it's interesting that they don't. They're completely standalone.
No, I really thought that.
But they overlap in theme.
Yeah, but like the first couple particularly, and again, I don't want to give away too many spoilers, but it's sort of clear as you go along. They end in these very sort of just almost anticlimactic ways for the title characters. It's just it ends quite badly.
Yeah,
because the theme of the whole thing is sort of about things ending badly.
It's really about death, like most Coen Brother movies.
Exactly, and I was sort of thinking that, you know, you get the James Franco character or whatever, and you think, well, he's going to come back later on. Somebody will rescue him, and it doesn't. That's not really that sort of a film.
What was your favourite of the six out of interest?
Definitely the gal who got rattled.
Yes.
I liked the Tom Waits one, especially.
Between those two for me.
Even just visually, it was astonishing. I felt like I could jump in and live in that.
Yeah.
I don't know where they filmed it, but it was just so lush and amazing how they shot that one in particular, I thought.
I also thought that I'm going to watch it again because I think it will reward multiple viewings, but I think the Liam Neeson one will get better with multiple viewings because it's an astonishing little vignette of a film. Yeah. Anyway, I could talk about this all afternoon, but we are out of time for you, David. So we're going to jump over to Sean.
I'm going to continue the media theme. I'm going to want to talk about Daredevil Season 3, which was sadly recently cancelled. Probably has a whole lot to do with Disney's streaming service that is opening up at some point next year. But yeah, Daredevil, I think as someone who's not a huge fan of the Marvel films, I think that the sort of Netflix Daredevil, The Punisher, and then just maybe to a lesser extent sort of Jessica Jones, Luke Cage, can sort of show that you can have a medium that's split right down the middle and sort of aimed at two completely different audiences and done in two different ways that isn't really seen a whole lot in other areas, I'd suggest, unless someone has a great example they're about to come across me with. But yeah, I think that as a series, it's continued. All three seasons have been super strong all the way through, it's pretty incredible.
I liked but didn't love it this year. I mean, I thought it was a definite step up from season two, which was pants. But I am not too saddened by the cancellation because I think for me, the Netflix Marvel shows peaked with Daredevil season one and Jessica Jones season one. And sort of everything from then on has been pale imitation of that for me. Everything's been sort of them trying to recapture that magic that those two seasons of TV, which I think those two seasons are phenomenal. And I just don't think anything they've done since has quite matched it. This year was a huge step up from before. I think a lot of that is having Vincent D'Onofrio back as Kingpin.
Yeah.
It shows how much he was missing from season two. Briefly there, but not in a big way.
You're not a fan of The Punisher?
Punisher was good.
Okay.
Again, but not. I think that, you know, the part of the problem is all these shows they're very long and they're very slow and they're padded out unnecessarily. I was disappointed that this didn't do what I think either Luke Cage 2 or Iron Fist 2 was a shorter episode count, 10 episodes.
Okay.
I was hoping they were going to do that for Daredevil 3 because I think that one of the biggest problems these shows have had is like 13 episodes and they never tell a 13 episode story.
Yes.
They tell an 8 episode story in 13 episodes.
Yeah.
And often they have characters rehash like the same moral crisis again and again and again. And it's like, yeah, I get the idea.
Yeah.
Like Daredevil's deciding whether to kill or not. Like, yes, yeah, the seventh time he's monologued about it in 3 episodes.
What does, for someone who's like completely superhero illiterate, what does Daredevil do? Does he dare to do things? Or
he's a blind lawyer.
Okay.
Who has super hearing from his sight loss, so
okay.
He fights crime in a devil costume.
Yeah, which is still bordering on the, you know, ludicrous, but he's a much more relatable superhero. Is kind of an oxymoron, right? But
he's,
I think
if you're blind,
he's an interesting one because he's Catholic as well. So a lot of it plays into Catholic guilt.
Yeah,
the idea of this Catholic dressed up as the devil. Why that? He's in the New York District Hell's Kitchen, which is kind of where it comes from, but. Sort of, you know, a lot of it plays on the religious themes, but in an interesting way. You know,
yeah.
I always like that stuff.
Did it just get cancelled? Did I see?
Yes,
it did.
Do we know why?
Disney streaming service platform. Probably. So basically cleaning house. Lobby. Luke Cage, Iron Fist, Daredevil, all gone.
Devil Lobby.
Anglicans.
The Punisher and Jessica Jones left. They both have new seasons next year, and everyone's expecting basically Netflix going to drop the season of each and then a week later say, and it's gone.
Okay.
And it's gone. It's clearly some pressure between the two companies to clear all that away so that Marvel can get those characters back.
Yeah, makes sense. Great, thanks, Sean. Karen?
Well, I'm not going to talk about any films on Netflix or TV series on Netflix or games because I don't have time for that sort of thing. I'm going to talk about the first of two Apple products that were announced this year, which were a little bit of a surprise, to be honest, because we kind of thought Apple was about to discontinue them. And I'm going to start with the Mac Mini. The Mac Mini was the Mac that was introduced like over a decade ago, and it was really aimed at switchers, people coming from Windows to Mac. And it was also really low cost, so it was like £399 when it launched, or something you just would not even imagine an Apple product being priced at today.
No, a quarter of a MacBook Air.
Yeah. So they have updated the Mac Mini, and it's not sort of your entry-level Mac anymore. It's still got a low price, £799, but in the scheme of things, that's a low price for a Mac. And it's pretty powerful, actually. I mean, Apple's looking at the market that was desperate for this Mac to be upgraded, and they are people who run server libraries and, you know, developers and people who need a powerful Mac, but they don't need an extra display. And, you know, they probably have one already, and keyboard and mouse and all of that stuff. So keep the price down. And they haven't changed the design, and part of that is because they're trying to fit it into these banks of servers, and people who've already committed 5,000 Mac Minis aren't going to want to get new racks to stick them in. So I thought it was pretty interesting that they actually updated a low-cost Mac rather than just continuing to sell incredibly high-priced products.
Mm. I thought what was interesting about it was the range of the specs you can get on this one now. Mm. Like, how it starts lowish, you know, 800, but you know, you put in all the top specs and it's a $4,000 machine. Like, there's a real breadth in the kind of options they put here to try and capture these two weird, very different markets they've got, which is sort of like people want an entry level cheap thing, or like to use it as a media streamer, and then, as you said, people who actually want a really high spec server kind of machine. I thought it was interesting that this thing ranges from 800 to four grand. And you get a lot of choice there, which you don't always get with Apple stuff. Often you're sort of, the base specs are fairly fixed and you just get to play around a little bit with storage or one processor option. You know, there's a lot more flexibility here.
So it's interesting as well because, I mean, partly because Apple hasn't updated the iMac this year, you've ended up with a Mac Mini that is comparable to a decent iMac and half the price or more, you know. So it's interesting because it's kind of left Apple fans in a position of like, you know, actually we can get a decent Mac for half the price.
Have you heard any sort of responses from people who have made that switch from Windows to Mac with this product, and do they like it better?
Well, the thing is, it's like the whole Windows switcher thing happened 10 years ago, and I think that it's not necessarily Apple's focus now with the Mac Mini.
Right.
Isn't about winning over Windows users, I don't think. I think that was the case like 10 years ago when we had more than 10 years ago when we had the Intel Switch and they were doing their Switcher campaign and you had all the adverts, PC and Mac, remember that? I think now it's about new markets of people like, you know, the developers who've come over to the Mac because they're developing for iOS and everything else. And, you know, you use the Mac because you can use Windows as well as everything else. Whereas on a Windows machine, you can't use Mac OS. And, you know, there are lots of reasons why people might be considering a Mac who hadn't before. But I don't think, it's not that Apple's trying to win them over with this machine. They're just trying to provide the machine that those people need to do what they're doing, so.
Great, thanks, Karen. I am going to talk about another thing on Netflix, which is a running theme. I'm going to talk about the Alex Garland sci-fi movie Annihilation. It's one of the best films I've seen all year, in a year where there weren't that many great sci-fi movies. For a little bit of context, it's the British novelist, now filmmaker, Alex Garland, who made Ex Machina a few years ago, which is another fantastic sci-fi movie. It follows a band of women led by Natalie Portman who kind of venture into this strange area called the Shimmer, where kind of the rules of nature and evolution have all gone haywire. it is a very, very bizarre film that has a really unique kind of atmosphere to it. It's kind of split into three defined acts. The first act is quite strange in its own. The second act is a bit like an action movie set in the Shimmer, and then the third act is one of the most bizarre things you're ever going to see. Paired with a magnificent soundtrack that kind of rings in your ears. I was lucky enough to see this in a cinema because I was in the US when it got its limited release, and I'm really glad that I got to
see in the cinema.
Yeah. I'm really glad I got to go and see it there. Dom, I know you're also a fan of this film.
I absolutely loved it, and I was fuming that Scott got to see it on the big screen. It was a big thing that it just went straight to Netflix here in the UK, and we never got cinema release. And now Netflix does do cinema releases. 6 months later, it started doing 1 week cinema releases for a lot of its big films, like Ballad of Buster Scruggs and Roma, the Alfonso Cuarón film that's just come out. But this spring, it didn't do that at all. So I'm still sort of holding out for repertory screenings at the Prince Charles Cinema or somewhere like that, because I'd love to see it on the big screen. The visuals are stunning. The effect stuff is stunning, sort of both practical and digital.
Yeah.
It's gnarly and grisly and gross.
Yeah, there's weird. A couple of bits in that middle section involving kind of animals and the insides of people, which really will stick with you.
I really wanted to love it because I thought conceptually it was cool, and I thought it was kind of distilling like some of Tarkovsky's stuff, but for like a mass audience, which was really cool. But I got lost sort of at the halfway point with all the action stuff because I felt the CGI was so cheap and tacky.
Really?
It just really, really, really threw me off. Yeah,
I didn't think that at all.
Yeah, well, I thought that bear creature.
It's the scariest thing anyone's put on screen this year.
Yeah, I agree.
The bear was, horrible, horrible sequence.
Terrifying.
Well, I heard similar things about the CGI in Buster Scruggs, actually, and I didn't feel this myself, but my friend watched it, and the bit particularly with the angels going up to heaven, but various other bits like the fingers getting shot off and stuff like that.
I feel like that was a stylistic choice.
Well, yeah, that's what I thought too, but he felt like because it had been done for Netflix, they'd cut the budget somehow.
So I don't think Netflix are cutting the budget.
I think they'd have enough money.
Although I read somewhere they all tend to be shot on a similar kind of camera, so they've all got a similar aesthetic look to them, similar sort of colours and things.
Oh, really?
But
I'm sure Roma won't have that problem.
No.
I didn't feel that way about Buster Scruggs at all. No, it didn't take me out of it. But with Annihilation, it really did for some reason. Maybe because I was watching it on a crappy TV.
That's what I was going to say. Maybe it's the standard of your television.
It is also
quite bizarre. If you've got a really great TV, maybe it looks worse because,
While we discuss Netflix budgets and things, Annihilation is released by Netflix in the UK, but it wasn't actually made by Netflix. So it's not a Netflix original in that sense. So any question about Netflix budgets or camera setup won't really apply. It was made for a studio in the States, which is why I had the theatrical release.
When we were prepping for this podcast, and I use inverted commas for prepping.
frantic Googling 5 minutes before.
I was at one point considering cheating and just kind of saying Netflix as my thing, because I just think they've had such a phenomenal year in terms of quality of output. And I think they will be having a very sort of lavish Christmas party this year, because Roma, Buster Scruggs, Annihilation are all possible Oscar candidates across the board. And that is what they've wanted for a long time. I know they I know they screened three movies at Cannes last year, but none of them really kind of took the cultural kind of conversation away. And this year they've really done that.
We were talking about... Sorry, go on.
I was just going to say, because that's just made me think, next year, we reckon sort of March, April, Apple is going to announce its kind of competitor to Netflix, going to start offering streaming content that it's making right now. And I just feel like, have they got hope in hell of competing, really?
They're just behind, aren't they?
They're so late to the party.
Yeah, so late.
Disney gets to get away with being late because it comes with the biggest IP.
It's the catalogue, yeah.
But Apple doesn't.
Yeah.
We were talking about this the other day, Scott. I'm curious as to if these Netflix originals, in like the real sense, if they're informed by like data analytics and what people like from like open social media channels. And if so, are we going to get to a point where like, there's a kind of new formulaic where themes and sort of acts of suspense get repeated because that's what the data says.
Well, yeah, if you look at the... I can't remember who sent this round.
House of Cards was the original, wasn't it? Where they worked out the people that like Kevin Spacey, also like David Fincher, and also like the original UK House of Cards. And therefore they made...
But also they worked out... They worked out that people like movies where people fall in love with members of the royal family, and they've put out about three of those this year. So there are certain sort of genre tropes that they definitely... pull through their analytics engine and then they just supply that demand.
I feel like we spoke about this once before about how there's a real emphasis on like violence and all of the kind of things I don't like watching on Netflix and Amazon and everything else, because that's what people want to watch. So there's a massive amount of that kind of content and not much.
But also they made a black and white sort of personal movie from famous Mexican director, which is not violent.
I was going to say, it's worth making a point. There's going to be a distinction there between the stuff they're making for mass market, so to speak, and the stuff like Buster Scruggs and Roma, which is them trying to get the kudos, trying to get the awards cred, where they will go to a big filmmaker. And almost all of these filmmakers say of working with Netflix that they've had more creative freedom than they ever got in the studio system.
Really? Mm-hmm. Yeah, they love it. They really do love it.
It's the BuzzFeed News thing. It's they want to have the prestige division.
Yeah.
And everything is paid for by
relentless
data-driven clickbait.
So I don't think they're going to Alfonso Cuarón and saying the algorithm says this, Alfonso, you've got to make this film. That's Alfonso, here's a budget, do whatever you want with it.
Alfonso, someone else our algorithm, say we don't like black and white.
Yeah.
So don't film in black and white. We've gone way over there. We're going to take a short break in between our two things, and then we'll be right back.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
And we're back. Dom, what is your second thing?
I'm going to continue on with the sort of the film trend, though this isn't a Netflix one. I was really struggling with this. I put together a film top 10 of the year the other day, and that was hard enough. Trying to then pick one of them to go for was even trickier, so I am going to have an honorary mention briefly at the end. But my pick actually is Mission Impossible.
I'm so glad you just said that.
Which it took a lot of thought, and I can't quite believe it's my favorite film of the year, though in retrospect, Ghost Protocol was probably my favourite film of the year. That came out way back when. But I liked but didn't love Rogue Nation. It's the same director returning, Christopher McQuarrie. But oh my God, Mission Impossible Fallout is a bloody stunner of a film.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't watched a Mission Impossible since the original, but I watched Fallout the other day and it is phenomenal.
It is incredible. No one has made an action movie like this in a decade.
I've heard it's really
best
good as well.
Action movie this year, bar none, by far, not even a close second.
It's so ludicrous.
I always complain that because of superhero films, nobody makes Die Hard anymore. Is Mission Impossible now Die Hard?
It's not a Die Hard, but it's what you want James Bond to be.
It's Bond, yeah. It's Bond on steroids.
Yeah, it is big and practically made, almost all of it. You know, they throw Tom Cruise out of a plane at high altitude. They make Tom Cruise fly a helicopter, all this stuff. And there's that thrill of knowing I'm watching Tom Cruise almost die. But it's all so brilliantly done.
And there's only one greater thrill than that.
there's a massive bathroom fist fight that is obviously an homage to True Lies, but is also just the best fist fight anyone's put on screen this year, probably. Henry Cavill reloads his arms mid-fight, which is just brilliant.
Henry Cavill is so great in this film.
I hated Henry Cavill until Fallout, and now I love Henry Cavill.
Henry Cavill in that helicopter sequence is just some of the best stuff on screen this year.
They make him actually do these things.
Me and David Tom are just smiling because we used to work with his brother. He used to work here.
Well, he's the Channel Islands finest, isn't he, Henry Cavill?
But does it sort of signal a shift away from over-reliance on CGI in action films? Because I feel that's what kind of puts me off with action films also.
It's not a shift away. It's what Mission Impossible has long made its selling point. And a sort of a thing that makes this series stand out is ever, especially since Ghost Protocol onwards, they've made a point of saying, we're the practical effects action movie series. We're the one where we actually get the helicopter, we actually get the plane, and particularly we actually make Tom Cruise do it all. And he's, you know, they've always led their marketing with this. You know, they sort of made this rare thing of doing a marketing push for the film a year and a bit before it came out, because they put Tom Cruise and the cast on the Graham Norton show to show off footage where he'd actually fucked his leg up.
He really hurt himself, didn't he?
Doing a stunt.
Wasn't that in London as well? Was that the roof jump?
London. So he was doing a roof jump between two roofs in London for this amazing foot chase across, like, from St. Paul's to the Tate Modern over Blackfriars Bridge, which Tom Cruise actually did this run over all the...
He runs for honestly about 8 minutes straight at a full sprint. It's phenomenal.
He did a jump between two roofs, screwed up the landing, snapped something in his leg. Like, you see the footage, and his foot was in where his feet shouldn't go. But being Tom Cruise, he then lands, he gets up, and he runs off. And that shot is still in the movie. And if you look, you can see the point where he slightly drags his right leg behind him as he guns off after. Because that's the shot they had, and they were like, yeah, it works.
What a pro.
We still got the shot. They had to stop filming for 6 months. But it is mind-blowing. It keeps finding ways to top itself. If you watch any of the trailers, you'll think, oh, I've seen all the best bits. You haven't. It gets better and better and better. I saw it twice in the cinema. I can't wait to see it again. It was genuinely that kind of jaw-dropping experience where you kept going, they're not gonna. How did they? And it keeps getting better and better and better and building and building and building. And my biggest hope now for sort of, you know, future action stuff is that Christopher McQuarrie is the person who steps in to direct the Bond after the next one. The first post-Daniel Craig Bond in sort of 4 or 5 years' time. I hope it's McQuarrie, because if he could bring that kind of energy to the Bond franchise with a new Bond, you know, that'd be a great way to bring Bond back and bring it slightly lighter in tone, but without being sort of goofball Roger Moore. That'd be phenomenal.
I think they should do Bond as a period piece.
I'd love that. That'd be great. My quick honorary mention is Mandy, which is a little Nicolas Cage film, which had a very brief run in cinemas for like a week or two and is now out on home entertainment. It's really nuts. It's the only time any film has ever genuinely made me feel like I was on hallucinogens. Not that I've tried hallucinogens.
You can imagine.
Weird. It's dark. It's gory. It's horrible. Nicolas Cage grins at the camera like a fucking terrifying lunatic. It's the most Nicolas Cage film without being a parody of Nicolas Cage films. Yeah. It's an art house Nicolas Cage film that's the most Nicolas Cage and the least Nicolas Cage at once. There's a chainsaw fight, like two chainsaws, one of which is a super long chainsaw for some reason. There's some like gimp devils. There's an evil like religious cult. It's phenomenal.
The use of colour in that film was amazing. It was like a giallo film. It was like a giallo doom metal music video that lasted for 2 hours. And it was fantastic. Yeah. I really loved it.
The soundtrack as well, I've completely forgotten his name, but the Icelandic, I think, composer who died, Johan Johansson, it was his last score. And it's breathtaking as well.
Psychic castration and more. What more could you want?
Really phenomenal.
I'm going to have to cut you off. Tamlin.
So to speak.
I think it's funny that we all obviously want to be film critics.
Yeah.
But my favourite thing of this year in terms of film wasn't a new release this year. It was the platform film Struck that has sadly gone, because I started throwing myself into cinema without sounding too pretentious, like more seriously late last year. I discovered it this year, and it's got like half of the Criterion collection on it and some really interesting pieces that you probably would have difficulty pirating if you couldn't track down the DVD copy. So it was a really great introduction into a lot of things that I otherwise wouldn't have seen. Like I saw a Soviet film called The Ascent, which was just ludicrously brutal black and white story about two Soviet soldiers who end up in Nazi territory. And yeah, it's just really bleak. But I would never have even heard of it had that platform not been around. So RIP Filmstruck.
RIP Filmstruck, but I've heard that there's some form of replacement on the way. Is it a new Criterion product?
Yeah, Criterion are going to be more heavily involved, I think. Okay. I can't remember the exact details, but they are going to relaunch it in some capacity, I think.
Yeah.
In the UK, you didn't have the full Criterion collection on there, but you had a decent chunk of it. In the US, you had, I think, every Criterion release.
Yeah,
so I'm amazing. Yeah, so I'm hoping that they manage to bring that to the UK, because that would just be like a really valuable thing. So much value for money just for a tenner a month, access to all those amazing films.
Nice.
But also, the closest thing we have in the UK right now, if you want an interim thing, is Mubi, which isn't quite the same in that there's only 30 films at a time, but they add a new film every day and take away a film every day. And it is a really interesting mix. You get the nice curations. You don't have a limitless library to browse. You've just got 30 films to look at any given time. And they pick some really interesting stuff. Some will be recent films, but they will find, you know, strange little black and white movies from the 30s, foreign stuff from the 60s. It's all over
Argentine
the place.
Classics from the 70s that you'd never have heard of.
It's lovely. And there's great curation. They also let you know why they've picked that film. So they often do little strands where they'll do a certain director for a few days, or some guest director will come in and pick a few films for a few days.
Oh, that's nice.
Stuff like that. Yeah, it's not quite the same thing, but if you're looking for that kind of place in your streaming library, movies are the best bet right now.
Cool. Pirating stuff is really good as well. We don't endorse it, but it's wicked though.
That sounded a bit like an endorsement.
Well, you know.
Bryce.
So you were all expecting me to say the Apple Watch Series 4.
Yeah,
and the Apple Watch Series 4 is a very, very good product.
Oh, there
you
go. Should all... No, don't start talking
the second generation Apple Pencil. And I really like that. And it's an interesting sort of case study in why doing a product really badly is quite helpful when you make the follow-up. Because the original Apple Pencil, it was a very good stylus, but had all sorts of practical issues with it. You had to charge it. You had to plug it into the lightning port of an iPad, which meant that it stuck right out, and it was very easy to sort of break it off almost and damage the lightning port and all these sort of things. And you never actually charged it because of that. So whenever you got it out, it'd run out of battery. And the new one, it has a flat edge on one side and you just magnetically attach it to the iPad and it wirelessly charges, which means that whenever you get it out, it has charge and it's easy to use. And it's just much better.
Functionality-wise, does it work like a charm as well?
Yeah, so, well, the original Apple Pencil was probably the best stylus for the iPad that you could get, and it was very, very good. This is just as smooth, just as responsive, because it's speaking directly to it. It's not a dumb stylus. But it also has a new double tap feature on the flat edge that you use for the magnetic attachment. You can also double tap that. And depending on which app you're using, that will then switch from like write to erase or whatever they've implemented on that specifically. But it's not, you know, it's not a very exciting product. When it came out with the new iPad Pro, it didn't get quite as much attention, but it's a really, really good stylus, and they've improved it in a really sensible and I would almost say humble way, that they've acknowledged that they really dropped a bollock on it, on its practical side, on the charging stuff. And
was it humble or was it courage?
They're not going to use that word again.
No.
I think it's brilliant.
So it works with the new iPad that was introduced in March as well?
No,
it doesn't.
Right.
Only the new iPad Pro.
Yeah, it's the funny thing is that each iPad or iPad Pro can either use the old Apple Pencil or the new one. There is no overlap at all. So the iPad 9.7 inch 2018 only uses the first, and the new ones only use the second. So it's a bit weird.
So do you think that's Apple basically trying to make the iPad Pro more appealing by giving it this pencil that can use?
It certainly does make it more appealing. But there's plenty of good stuff about the new iPad Pro as well. The lack of home screen, the lack of home button means it's got a much bigger screen to body ratio, and it's very, very powerful. It's had a double jump in processor, and I'm ending up talking about three Apple products.
You are.
So yeah, buy the Apple Pencil.
Great.
Jump. If you've got an iPad Pro.
Yes, if you've got a new iPad Pro.
I'm going to do a hard right turn and talk about AMD, who this year have released a slew of products and done really well. The reason why I want to highlight this is because, much in the sort of way that Nvidia have with graphics cards, Intel were pretty much dominating the high-end processor market for both commercial and consumer for a while. And then AMD, the plucky underdog that everyone loves to love, came out of nowhere and done some really good stuff. So their Ryzen 2 series, which launched at the start of this year, which is topped off by the 2700X, has more cores than the Intel counterpart, is cheaper, and also comes with some incredibly good CPU cooling out of the box. So you're getting better value for money, and it's also cheaper, which is great. AMD have also sort of taken over the space between consumer and sort of server level processors with the Threadripper range, which Intel are sort of retreating from by en masse. And they're doing this while also producing graphics cards to go up against Nvidia. And yeah, just in general, they're providing some sort of competition to a region where Intel really had a bit of a monopoly.
I heard, actually, talked to some journalists at the thing yesterday, that Intel have been poaching a bunch of AMD execs recently.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting because, I mean, they've coasted for a long time, right?
Yeah, yeah, they really have. And it's sort of, you know, and this is what NVIDIA is very much doing the same thing that Intel were doing a few years ago, where they're just not really being challenged. And you sort of feel, the other reason why you've got a lot of AMD is because they're competing against NVIDIA and Intel in different market spaces. And they're, you know, taking market control from Intel off one, which is kind of incredible. And also, I mean, they do other things like, you know, if you basically want to get the latest Intel processors, you're going to need another motherboard. You need to buy a new motherboard, which isn't cheap, obviously. David's nodding like he understands.
Obviously. That whole problem.
Yeah, whereas AMD will...
another bloody motherboard.
another motherboard. AMD will let you... they're making their processors backwards compatible, so use the same socket. So you can just buy a new processor and put it into your current AMD motherboard, which, again, just reduces cost and everything else. So, yeah, thumbs up, AMD. Two thumbs up. AMD, if anything.
Wicked.
How are they doing in terms of market share? Are they genuinely clawing back some market share from Intel?
Yeah, a lot. The other thing is, well, they've sort of pioneered the APU movement, which is a CPU and a GPU on one chip, which means that if you want to sort of do any low-end gaming on a laptop, it's their Raven Ridge range, which means that games like, they're still quite recent, but are perhaps less graphically intensive, such as Overwatch or things like that, you can pick up an AMD laptop with this APU and it will do well. Whereas, you know, if on an Intel piece, or they're catching up in this area, it's still a bit ropey. So they didn't have that crossover over performance.
You can get like a fairly high-end Intel processor laptop and it just will struggle with gaming if you don't have the right get inside.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, you know, something where AMD moving forward. And what's interesting as well is today Intel announced their 10 nanometer architecture, which is coming later this year. Which is a big deal.
Is that tick or talk?
Either or. Right. So it'll be interesting to see how AMD follow up. There was rumours they're working on 7 nanometer. So if they can somehow leapfrog Intel, the next year is going to be very interesting because it will be a real market upset. I mean, there is an argument that Intel are focusing much more on sort of AI-related stuff, as self-driving cars. I mean, they're the ones sort of supplying all the hardware for that sort of stuff in that market. But yeah. Interesting times in processor land.
How much smaller can these processors get? Because 7nm processing is like,
yeah,
is insane.
That's an interesting question. I don't know. Obviously, smaller nanometer processors are better for a number of reasons. The electricity has less distance to travel, which means that information can move faster across the die. It also means that because it has to travel less far, it requires less power, which means less heat. And the main thing that kills clock speeds on a CPU is they just overheat. I mean, it was a few years ago where AMD managed to get a processor up to sort of like 9 gigahertz clock, but it just exploded afterwards. It just means like liquid helium to keep it cold. And if you see all these processor events, people sort of, you know, overclocking, just pouring liquid helium or nitrogen onto the motherboard just to keep it cool. But yeah, so good. All good. All
nice. Fun. Great. Karen, second thing.
Yeah, back to Apple.
Back to Apple.
So I did mention earlier that there was another Mac I was going to talk about, and it's the MacBook Air, which, like the Mac Mini, had kind of been left untouched for ages. I mean, Apple last updated the MacBook Air in 2015. And they had kind of done like tiny little updates to it in 16 and 17, but these were just like upping the spec according to the build to order options. So it still kept its Broadwell chip, which was like from 2014. You know, it was old, but surprisingly popular. And you know, the amount of people I knew who had just rushed out and bought a MacBook Air that was basically 4 years old, they really should have asked me. But we'd been thinking they were going to discontinue that, and they didn't. Well, I mean, it's not that big a surprise because there were plenty of rumours that they were going to update it. And the new MacBook Air it's had a redesign, so it's smaller and lighter. It's got a bit of a theme this year with Apple was reducing the bezels for bigger screens, and the MacBook Air also got that because the old MacBook Air, the bezels around the edge of the screen were like getting on for an inch, so. It looks a lot better. And the processor inside, although it's a sort of a more kind of basic processor, is still pretty decent compared to anything that's a few years old now. So it's really good. And actually, it kind of leaves the MacBook as a bit of a like, well, why would anyone buy that?
It's yeah, I was going to say they cannibalised the MacBook, didn't they?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a fraction smaller. There's not really much of a reason to buy the MacBook right now. And that hasn't been updated at all this year. So, you know, if you really need a smaller Mac right now, then, you know, don't buy a MacBook.
The 12-inch MacBook is a nightmare to type on.
Yeah.
But then the new new keyboard on the MacBook Air presumably isn't, I mean, it's bigger, but it's not going to be nice to type on.
Yeah, this is the thing. We love the keyboards on the older MacBook Air. It's got that kind of nice clackety feel. I don't know. People feel like they know they're pressing the keys. Yeah. And nowadays, keyboards, they're kind of, because they've made the Macs a lot slimmer, the keyboard's been redesigned. And there have been some issues with some of the keyboards in older Macs, older MacBooks, like from the 2016 sort of era. With dust getting trapped under the keys. So they've actually changed the keyboard design, although they haven't said that's why. And the new MacBook Air has this new keyboard. And yeah, I don't like it as much as the old MacBook Air keyboard, but it's one of those kind of price you have to pay if you want a slimmer Mac.
It's on my Christmas list. I'm going to wrap us off with another Apple product because I finally got a new phone this year. And I got the iPhone XR, and I love it. I absolutely love it. I, for a good 2 years, kind of struggled with a 16 gig model where it was constantly full.
Oh, how could anyone survive 16 gigabytes now?
I know, it was constantly full. It was it was slow. It was breaking down. It had about probably a 5 hour battery life by the end of it. Just upgrading to the XR, which thought long and hard, you know, between the XR and XS, and I don't feel like I bought a cheaper version of the product. I feel like I've got a really quality product on my hands.
That really is a surprise about the XR compared to the XS. It's like you could have seen the XR as a replacement for last year's X, or 10 even.
Yeah.
But it's got almost exactly the same spec as the XS. Plus, its battery life is better. So, you know. There are lots of reasons to prefer it.
Yeah, I've never run out of battery. I just got back from Iceland and I love the camera. It's great. I love it. And it's the best thing that I bought all year.
The portrait mode doesn't work on non-humans, does it?
It doesn't, no. The portrait mode is a bit more fake. So with the XS, it's kind of using the two cameras and it's been very clever and sort of bringing the two pictures together. It's all sort of software on the XR.
And
also, it doesn't give you that same sort of zoomed in effect that you get when you take portrait pictures with the X or the XS or any of them, because you're basically using exactly the same lens, so the picture looks no different. It's just the background that changes.
Clarify what you mean by non-humans.
Dogs.
Is that not a fairly cats. Simple?
Well, it could be objects. It could be cats. It could be dogs. So, it could be clouds.
The 10S, you can do any object. It can be a bottle. It could be a cat. But on the 10R,
cats
it's
are not objects, David.
Well, I mean, humans are objects technically. But on the 10R,
maybe you are.
The 10R has face recognition software built in, so it looks specifically for faces. Mm-hmm. So if your cat looked exactly like a person, then you'd be absolutely fine.
Get a Nicolas Cage looking cat.
Yeah. Cats usually look like Hitler, don't they? That's the most common one. But they act like Hitler. But anyway, it won't work.
Wow.
It won't. I don't know what I'm going off
getting
on.
Controversial in the final minutes of this podcast.
End the podcast. Yeah, but it won't work on a cat because it doesn't recognise it's a face. Therefore, it doesn't apply the portrait mode. And there you go.
Thanks.
Great. That is all we've got for you. Thank you very much for your patience with our coughing and spluttering. We're all sick in the office. We all are ready for the Christmas break.
And the Christmas party later.
Yes. I think this is probably our last pod of the year. If it is, thank you very much for listening, for putting up with us all year. And we will see you again in the new year. Thank you.
See you.
Bye-bye.
UK Tech Weekly Podcast.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here.
I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.